As we speak, Vietnam is suffering through a record heat wave with temperatures reaching 40 degrees Celsius. Yesterday, a pediatric hospital in Hanoi admitted 2,000 children, placing them 3 to a bed. This year, the hot season arrived a month early in Vietnam, an event attributed to climate change by the Vietnam Meteorological Service.
You can negotiate about the climate, but not with the climate.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we're continuing our coverage of the UN climate talks in Bonn. Well into the second week, the negotiators appear to be approaching gridlock, with the rich industrialised nations failing to make the required first moves. In this programme, we attempt to unlock what the stalemate is all about by looking at the concept of climate debt. But first, here's Wael Hamaden of the Arab Climate Coalition, speaking at the Climate Action Network press briefing at the start of week two in Bonn, summing up the state of play.
So what happened the past week? After sleepless days and nights of negotiations? Well, simply almost nothing. Everything has been moving at a snail pace. One of the most important issues being discussed last week is the issue of the aggregate target for Annex 1 countries by 2020 compared to 1990 level, and this is very important, how much the developed countries will do by 2020. This is important because so far the problem has been the lack of trust between developed and developing. The developed has failed to take action, and now for the world to move, for developing countries to take actions, we need the developed countries to say, this is what we're going to do now. Tell us what you're going to do. So the aggregate target discussion was based on a pledge and review process where countries say, developed countries say what they're going to do by 2020, and then they add all these numbers, and whatever number they reach is the number that they will do collectively by 2020. And this is not enough, because this way you cannot ensure environmental integrity. This bottom-up approach will not ensure that we are doing what we need to do to save the planet from climate change. What needs to be done? An aggregate target, science-based target that should be put there, and then divide this number according to the responsibilities and capabilities of each country. This pledge and review process has been pushed by the Umbrella Group, Canada, Japan, these countries, and the Secretariat did a summation of the pledges done so far, and the number they reached will commit the planet to a 4-degree world. This means if these numbers do not become more ambitious, that means the glaciers will disintegrate, the sea level will rise several feet, we'll have severe droughts, we'll have shortage in water. Definitely, we're letting go of the poorest and most vulnerable communities if we keep to these targets. They have to go much higher.
As Wael was explaining, the two essential components for agreeing a successful framework for avoiding catastrophic climate change are, firstly, agreeing an emissions budget that is consistent with the science, and then deciding on a fair way of allocating those remaining emissions between countries. One concept that is gaining support in the talks for understanding what a fair and just global climate deal might look like is called climate debt. At the end of the first week in Bonn, the Third World Network released a sign-on statement calling for the repayment of the debt that the elite minority of rich nations owe the poor majority nations due to their responsibility for causing, and so far failing to act significantly on, climate change. Later in the programme, we'll look at some of the support this demand has been getting. But first, here's Matthew Stilwell, who authored the primer on climate debt that accompanies the Third World Network Declaration, speaking by phone from Bonn a few days ago, and explaining what the EU delegation suggested last week are really difficult concepts.
Well, the concept of climate debt itself is quite simple. It suggests that those who are principally responsible for causing climate change should compensate those who are not, but who suffer its worst impacts. So in the case of whether it's a small farmer in Bangladesh or people on small island states who are suffering extreme weather, the idea is that those of us who are responsible for causing climate change should compensate them, and that where that compensation doesn't come, we have a debt to those people.
And it's a relatively small number of people in terms of the global population that are responsible for most of the historical emissions, is that correct?
That's right. So around 20% of the population is responsible for 70% of the emissions, so that's mainly those of us in the rich industrialised countries. If you think of the historical emissions of people in the United States or the UK, it's around 1,100 tonnes per person, whereas in China it's around 66 and in India it's around 23, so our responsibility is quite different.
And to some extent this kind of concept is recognised by the United Nations Framework Convention?
That's right, so it's set out in the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. And that reflects that the main proportion of greenhouse gases that have built up in the atmosphere and that are causing global warming were emitted by the developed countries. Therefore, and you know, we also have the capacity to respond to climate change, so we're the ones who should be taking a lead. Climate debt divides itself into these two pieces. One relates to the effects of climate change and one relates to the causes of climate change. So on the effects side, that's the adaptation debt, and that arises because of the impacts on people and the failure of the developed countries in many cases to provide sufficient compensation. And then on the emissions side, you have the problem is that obviously the historical emissions from the developed countries have built up in the atmosphere, taking up atmospheric space, and now there's very little left. And so those emissions are denying atmospheric space to the south that needs them in the course of its development, giving rise to an emissions debt. And so the combination of these two types of debt, the adaptation debt and the emissions debt, collectively the climate debt of the developed countries. And, you know, in our view, honouring that climate debt is an important part of the solution to climate change.
Okay, if we take those one by one, how might the adaptation debt be compensated or paid for?
So part of it is identifying the extent of the harms in developing countries and making sure that we have an independent process for evaluating the extent of the harms and quantifying them, and then ensuring that that level of finance is available in a funding mechanism to compensate developing countries. And in the small island states, the LDCs, and a number of the other developing countries have called for compensation mechanisms as part of the outcome in Copenhagen. And so those mechanisms provide, you know, one of the vehicles for honouring the adaptation debt.
I mean, there are a few proposals on the table, I believe.
You have a number of proposals from the developing countries on finance. The G77 as a group, 130 developing countries, have put forward a comprehensive proposal for an enhanced financial mechanism to implement the convention. And that calls for between 0.5 and 1% of the GNP of the developed countries to be made available for both adaptation and mitigation. And then I guess there have been a number of other proposals by developing countries as well, but the G77 proposal is the main one.
What other proposals are on the table, and do they kind of stack up? The G77 proposal that you just mentioned would be, if the maximum range was taken up there, that would be about, what is it, $700 billion a year, dollars or something?
Yeah, it's in that order.
Yeah.
It depends on what calculation of Annex 1 GNP you take. I think, you know, in a sense, if you think of the cost of impacts already, Kofi Annan has said that the impacts are, I think, in the order of $300 billion a year. And even if you just take Hurricane Katrina, the total economic costs of one event in one country were around $100 billion. So the costs are rising, and we need to bear that in consideration. And I think, you know, what we're saying is that it's actually very difficult to predict the future costs of global warming, and so what we need is a mechanism that is able to evaluate that and then provide that back to the Conference of Parties so that the parties can make sure the money's there on a regular basis.
Do you have any opinion on any of the other proposals that are on the table? There's a Norwegian, a Mexican proposal, and a proposal about taxing aviation, and there's also some money in the US cap and trade bill for adaptation.
That's right. I think there are a range of very good proposals, and in a sense we're going to need all of them. We need to try and raise money, I think, first from public budgets. That's the responsibility of the developed countries through assessed contributions. But then there are other sources that we can look to. The Norwegians have talked about auctioning a proportion of the different countries' assigned amounts before they're given to them to use, and so that provides one source of revenue. The benefits of that are that it's, in a sense, it's outside the control of treasuries, so that money is available without having to fight for it in the domestic process. So that's, I think, quite good. The Swiss have proposed a carbon tax, which I think is also an interesting proposal. And then there are talks about levies on international aviation, on trading in other emission permits. So, for example, a proportion of the revenues of the CDM, of JI, and of emissions trading, joint implementation and emissions trading, is also being thought of as a source of funding for adaptation. So there are a range of good proposals on the table. The question is how to bring them together.
Okay, I mean, some of them are insufficient in terms of how much money they'd raise. I think I've seen a figure in The Guardian a few days ago. The US has written $400 million into its cap and trade bill for adaptation, which, you know, presumably developing countries would consider derisory.
Yeah, that's one seawall.
Yes. The figure that The Guardian give for the amount from the aviation tax, if aviation was taxed at about 1%, that would give $10 billion a year, which isn't really of the order that we're talking about is necessary either.
That's right. And so I think we're really underestimating the extent of the challenge on across the board. You know, the level of proposed mitigation cuts by the Annex I countries are vastly inadequate, and so too is the financing. And you know, we really have to think hard about what we need to do if we want to curb climate change and address the impacts.
At the Climate Action Network press conference, they said that the EU seemed to be getting more interested in the Mexican proposal. Do you want to say something about that proposal?
Yeah, I think it's another interesting proposal. I think it's quite complementary to the proposal put forward by the 130 developing countries of the G77. There are some significant differences. One is that Mexico is proposing that developing countries also contribute to the fund. So you would have both developed and developing countries contribute. The developing country perspective on that is that, well, you know, our GNP is much lower than the developed countries by and large, and in accordance with the principle of common but differentiated responsibility, we're the ones who are, I guess, suffering the impacts rather than having caused them. Yeah. And so it's appropriate for the Annex I countries, the rich countries, to put the money into the fund first. So I think that's probably the major difference.
Mm. It's probably important to note that there have been some pledges, voluntary pledges from rich countries previously that remain unmet on adaptation. There's some quite large amounts outstanding, I believe.
Well, that's right, and this for us is where the concept of debt comes in, because if you have a commitment and you don't fulfil the commitment, then that can reasonably be characterised as a debt. And I think part of the challenge is that we sort of often promise things and then don't deliver, and then we come back to the negotiating table and try and start with a clean slate and forget the past failures. So in a sense, the concept of debt holds the North to account over time.
And what stage are the discussions at on this section? Are industrialised nations moving towards a realisation that they need to address this adaptation debt and really kind of looking at scaling up the amounts that they're able to give to address this?
Yeah, well, I don't think we're seeing that here in Bonn. I mean, the developing countries have really been quite strident in calling for financing, both for the national adaptation plans, for the existing work that's taking place, but then also for a much expanded effort under the under the convention in future. The EC in its draft EC communication had a figure of $10 billion for adaptation total, which is just, you know, clearly inadequate. And so I think we really need to see a step change in the level of ambition from the developed countries.
Okay, and it's important what comes out of the... There's an EU finance ministers meeting today, I think. They could allocate a substantial amount if they saw fit to do so.
That's right, and I think, you know, doing that is a really important signal for the negotiations. If the developing countries, the AOSIS countries, the least developed countries, feel that their future is at risk, then they're really unlikely to, I think, to make the kind of concessions that the Annex I countries are calling on them to do. And, you know, many of the countries have said we're not willing to sign a suicide pact. And, you know, to address that, you need very deep cuts in the north and you need a lot of money on the table.
Mm. So in terms of the kind of remaining emissions budget, if you like, because if you want to avoid dangerous climate change, you've got very little room for manoeuvre in terms of the amount of greenhouse gases that we can safely emit over the next few decades, really. What does the concept of climate debt say about how that remaining greenhouse gas budget should be allocated amongst rich and poor nations?
So the concept of the emissions debt takes a look both at the future carbon budget and also how the carbon budget in the past has been allocated. And it looks at giving a fair allocation through time between, you know, say 1800 and 2050. And it looks at how you would share that budget equitably between the rich and the poor countries. When we sort of do that analysis, what we see is that the developed countries have already consumed more than their fair share and have actually consumed some of what should reasonably be given to the developing countries. So you have an emissions debt. The challenge then is that, you know, of course, the Annex I countries are going to continue emitting and, in a sense, continuing to go further into debt. So they obviously need some part of the budget, but then the difference between that and their debt is the basis for financing and technology to be provided to developing countries to live within the small remainder. I think one of the concerns is that the amounts of emission reductions proposed by the developed countries are far too low, and so what they're doing is actually taking a very large share of the remaining budget from the developing countries, and in our view that's both inequitable and unsustainable. The rich can't continue emitting at levels that are close to the levels that caused climate change while expecting the poor countries to live on much less.
Okay. How does this fit in, if at all, with the proposals of contraction and convergence and greenhouse development rights?
So it's complementary. In fact, we've worked very closely with the authors of the GDR and they've helped a huge amount in developing the work in the convention, supporting some of the governments. The idea of the carbon budget is that you look back to 1800 and run right through until the future. And so the focus really is on sharing the atmospheric space. The GDR's focus more on sharing the effort required to live within the remaining atmospheric space. And so they set up a responsibility and capability index as the basis for allocating that space. But if you apply the two methodologies, you come up with very similar conclusions. And I think it just demonstrates that any principled approach to allocating the remaining space shows that what's on the table from the developed countries is really quite inadequate.
And I guess one part of the problem with the industrialised country proposals is that they are proposing to meet a lot of their targets through the mechanism of offsets.
That's right.
In developing countries.
Yeah.
So that kind of takes more of the atmospheric space yet again than would be apparent if you just looked at their targets.
Exactly. So if you take the EC proposal, they propose cutting by 30% by 2020, and they call for a deviation by the developing countries from their baseline emissions of around 15 to 30%, and that translates into the US continuing to pollute at around 14 tonnes per capita and locking India in at around 2.6 tonnes per capita. And so you can see how inequitable it is. You know, every person in the United States would get effectively a right to the atmosphere of 14 tons per capita, and we'd lock Indians in it at much lower levels. And then, of course, the Europeans are proposing that around half of their amount would be achieved through offsets in other countries. So you'd actually be asking Indians to reduce their per capita emissions even lower so that the rich can have cheap emissions. So we have a situation which is, I think, quite unjust, but importantly for climate change, I think unsustainable, because you know, I can't imagine a politician in India being able to convince their public that they should live on 2.6 tonnes per capita when the rich are living on 14.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to mention or talk about?
I think one thing when thinking about per capita emissions, people often say, well, we should all converge at 2 tonnes per capita in 2050, but I think there are a couple of challenges with that. One is that, you know, you can imagine a wealthy country living very well on 2 tonnes per capita with appropriate technology, with all of the infrastructure and know-how available. And you can imagine a poor country living in great poverty on 2 tonnes per capita. And so the challenge really is, I think, adjusting the per capita amounts by some amount reflecting the different levels of technology and finance in different countries. It may be that the developing countries actually need more per capita emissions than the developed countries to develop. That's one of the concerns about contraction and convergence, I think, from many of the developing countries.
That was Matthew Stirwell, who authored the primer on climate debt, which accompanied the sign-on declaration issued last week by Third World Network. Next week, we hope to be speaking to Meena Raman of Third World Network to find out what kind of support the Corps for Repayment of Climate Debt has been getting. But even prior to the issue of the sign-on statement, there have been a number of significant high-level endorsements. Bolivia, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Honduras, Nicaragua and Venezuela have issued a declaration calling for the repayment of climate debt. The Sri Lankan Environment Minister gave a speech calling for an index to measure environmental debt. In April, Bolivia put in a formal submission to the UN climate talks on climate debt. Also in April, the Global Indigenous Peoples Summit issued a declaration calling on rich countries to repay this debt. The Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, representing 63 NGOs from across Africa, issued a similar call, as did the Trade Union Conference of Latin America and the Caribbean. Rather than repaying their debt and honouring their commitments under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to act first, rich countries are continuing to compound their debt. This week, two critical opportunities to change this and move towards a successful deal in Copenhagen were squandered when Japan announced its greenhouse gas target for 2020, a disappointing and inadequate 8% cut compared to 1990 levels. And the EU finance ministers, who met on June 9th and 10th, postponed a decision on allocating adaptation funds for poor countries. Climate Action Network International, the main NGO grouping at the talks, who represent over 450 environment, development and faith groups, wrote to the finance ministers of the G8 countries on the 8th of June. They said, quote, "Developed nations need to provide new and additional financial resources for adaptation and mitigation, totaling at least $150 billion annually, on top of current overseas development assistance commitments," unquote. But as an immediate first step, they must honour an 8-year-old pledge to provide $2 billion in adaptation monies for the least developed countries. Here's Salimul Huq, senior fellow at the International Institute for Environment and Development, speaking at a Cannes International press briefing in Bonn.
As I said, adaptation is not about Copenhagen and after 2012. It's about now. Indeed, it's about past commitments. I'll give you one example. 8 years ago in Marrakesh at the 7th Conference of Parties in 2001, the Conference of Parties set up a fund for the least developed countries, the 50 of the poorest countries that I mentioned, to provide them with assistance to carry out something called a NAPA, a National Adaptation Program of Action, to identify urgent and immediate adaptation projects. These countries have now completed, most of them, their NAPAs, and they've identified the projects that they need to do on an urgent and immediate basis, and they want to implement them. But there isn't enough money in the fund for them to implement it. The total cost of implementing all the 50 NAPAs is likely to be in the order of $2 billion. The amount of money in the fund, the LDC fund, which was set up at the time of Marrakesh with pledges from the rich countries, is less than $200 million. So it's an order of magnitude too low. And this is an eight-year-old pledge that has not been fulfilled by the rich countries, which they made 8 years ago. So there's an immediate agenda with respect to adaptation finance of fulfilling this eight-year-old pledge as soon as possible. This is not tied to getting a deal in Copenhagen, except in the sense that if they don't keep their old promises, then any new promises they give in Copenhagen will not be worth the paper they're written on.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme, and we'll wrap up our coverage of the bond talks next week with the post-talks assessment from various key players. In the meantime, you can get references for this week's programme and hear the show again by visiting the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. We're going to leave you with a recording of Phil Bloomfield of Oxfam International, launching a report earlier today, June 11th, called Hang Together or Hang Separately, which gives their version of what needs to happen to seal the deal in Copenhagen, and is another example of how the really difficult concept of climate debt has been taken up by the global justice movement. Thanks for listening.
First of all, just to say that we're here today because climate change is upon us. Science is telling us that we have to start acting, but also the human impact, the human experience of climate change, particularly of poor countries, is also why we're here. And our work across 70 countries in the world, working with many organisations of the poor, many communities of the poor, is where we're seeing lives changing and people living with dangerous climate change already. And that's why Oxfam believes that 2009 is possibly the most important year in human history, because it will define whether the planet heads for a better future of climate security or whether we head for a much more hot and glowering planet. So the new report is trying to make sure that we make a positive contribution to that debate. It sets out a fair and pragmatic way to deliver emission cuts. It tries to answer two of the biggest questions that are paralysing the negotiations at the moment. First of all, who cuts the emissions and by how much? And secondly, who pays for the cuts in those emissions? And unfortunately, we have a sense of paralysis in the negotiations at the moment, which has to be broken if we're going to get any kind of agreement for Copenhagen in December. It says effectively that the rich countries have a double duty to both cut their emissions by 40% by 1990. It's the only way we can get to anywhere near what we need. But even so, those rich countries have already occupied historically all the space in the atmosphere that should be available to developing countries for their own development. And therefore, rich countries have a double duty to also pay for the mitigation that's necessary for developing countries, effectively to make sure that they can develop with far less carbon pollution going into the atmosphere, because rich countries have already occupied that space.